told me, he said, you know, he says, it's great fun to have somebody like Hickel or Bucci. He said, oh, it's great fun, because he said they deny it. And then he says, we know it's true. And so he says, it's great fun. We can just pound on them until they get it. And so he said, don't come anymore. I don't want you. He said, and we had some screw up, you know, I remember the one in the court that the guy had stolen all the furs from Margaret and Victor furs. And somehow he was acquitted in court. And they gave him the furs, but they were Martin Victor's furs. And I like, we're $20,000, whatever. And he says, what about that? I said, sit down, the outrage. We were so stupid. I said, I can't imagine that stupidity, you know. And he said, oh, hell, that's no fun. I want to just say, no, he didn't do that. He stole them. I said, no.
It wasn't our fault. It was the one-armed man.
Yeah, it was this guy. Well, we had other things like that, you know. I think one time we gave the narcotics to the guy or something, you know. Or we would order the juvenile to make restitution, but you wouldn't tell, you couldn't publish the name of the juvenile, so you couldn't get the restitution because you didn't know the kid's name.
You know who it was.
Yeah. And then you'd go over to the probation, you'd look in the kid's file, and there'd be several $1,000. And they'd say, what about this? I said, listen, nobody can explain that satisfaction. I think we had won $8,000 or $10,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And they came in, they were just in the file. There were money orders. You know, and so, and there were other stupid things. You know, something happened, or this happened, or that happened. And all you could say is, don't ever believe in the conspiracy theory that the people get together and do this. I said, you can do horrible things by sheer stupidity.
They just happen.
They happen.
They just happen.
If the conspirators did this, they were dumber than you thought.
Yeah, we can do this all by ourselves.
Yes, yeah, we don't need any help, and there's no thought gone into this.
Oh, gracious. Okay, hold on just a moment. Let me get focused here. Get my gear on.
Got circulation back in your legs?
Yeah, I do. I can stand still now. Okay, on one.
Hey, Bob, we're at the time where you decided it's time to move on and try something else in your life. Let's proceed from there.
Well, I went back into private practice with a law firm for 3 or 4 years, and then I moved to another law firm, and we started building again, and one thing led to another, and finally we had a law firm of 14, 15 people and that sort of thing. And, you know, and then it sort of gradually restricted down until I was practicing again. My daughter then graduated from law school, and so we formed a law firm, Irwin & Irwin, about 2000. And then I sort of kept right on practicing and had some health problems, but then I managed through them. And then finally now she's a partner with Joe Palmier, and I work out of their office. I have my own thing, but I basically work for my daughter now. And so I still do what I've done for years, a lot of appeals. Unfortunately, if you live long enough as a lawyer, you get to probate your friend's estates. And I appear as an expert witness, and of all things, attorney malpractice. About 15 years ago, we looked around and we were having some terrible attorney malpractice cases, and nobody would testify. You had to go outside of Alaska to find some attorney, and some of the cases were really, really bad. I mean, we're not terrible things that happened. Economic consequences were terrible. And so I volunteered to be a witness. I figured if I believed in our profession that somebody had to stand up. And I said, I didn't have any. I knew what would happen if you did so. They would line up to attack you if you could. I figured, oh, what the hell, I have a thick skin. I've been in public life a long time. I'll do that. So I started to appear, and after the first 3 or 4 cases, other people started to come forward. And so, and now we have a balance of that as to what testimony in the community and so forth. And in my opinion, it's a check on attorneys. We have a lot more attorneys than we ever had. Some of them are well-trained, some of them are not so well-trained, and they take on cases where, if you have a license, you can get any case there is, theoretically, whether you have the ability to handle it is something else again. So I still do that, and from that standpoint, I don't appear in court anymore. I figure at my age, litigation is fairly far out. It has a physical component to it at that age, much over 55 or so. It is really difficult to do anything with, particularly trials that last more than 2-3 days. You're just not up to that as you get older. I enjoy the appeal process, and as I say, at the present time, I think I have, well, in my guess right now, I have 4 appeals to do in a writ of certiorari United States Supreme Court. So you get that. It's not for lack of work to do, I guess, from that that aspect of it. But the practice has changed in 25 years. I came off the court in 77, and almost 30 years now. And maybe it's just the sheer number of lawyers and the fact that you would only know the same 50 or 60 that you always knew. And so instead of 50 or 60 out of 100 or 150, it's 50 or 60 out of 2,000. They don't know you from Adam. Therefore, what used to be a sort of a collegial your discussion with a friend or somebody you knew reasonably well in their limitations. Large times you deal with people you have no idea who they are, and somewhere along the line, lawyers adopted the idea that to be aggressive is a better way to represent your client. That means, a lack of courtesy, a suggestion that you may not be doing the right thing, that you don't know what you're doing. And it's a fairly difficult thing because, strangely enough, we don't have any more good trial attorneys now than we had 30 years ago. We have people who talk about trials but who don't go to trial. And so we used to say, 40 years ago, there were 20 really top trial lawyers. Well, there are probably only 35 top trial lawyers now, and so you know them all well, and they deserve their reputation. So you can't understand where this aggressive thing, and the judges see it. I mean, it may be in speech, it's in attitude, it's in always calling the other guy a name or two, or denigrating his ability, or that type of thing, which is unfortunate, I think. The judges uniformly, however, condemn this, yet they have little success in changing it. They talk about it all the time, and short of just really doing some, being fairly short in the courtroom, which I feel is justified, they don't. They allow lawyers to say and do things which I, bringing them up short. They don't do that in federal court. Federal court is very strict on what you can do and can't do. State court still proceeds in giving them far more leeway than they should. And I'm not for pounding people down or enforcing a rigid code of conduct, but there is a part of this which rational discussion is helped by courtesy, not by, we have these people who now pour gasoline on problems instead of help solve problems, which is a really difficult thing. We don't need a cheerleader. We need somebody who understands their problem and tells them exactly where the position is.
Civility is really lacking. There's no doubt about that. Everywhere, not just...
Yeah, it's very hard. And it has nothing to do with whether you... It really does affect the way you try the thing. And, of course, if you don't have a lot of experience in trial, which, of course, that's the ultimate part of our business. If you can't resolve the dispute, you have to try it. If you don't have a lot of skill or experience in trial, the guy on the other side who does has a huge advantage over you. I mean, your client is not going to do well in court without an experienced trial attorney. And, that's just the way it is. And trying to take young lawyers, and I've had a number, and so forth, is to say you need that experience before you go out and badger the other guy. And it's awful hard to ask for favors after you insult somebody.
If you could change one thing in the entire justice system, what would you change?
I guess other than when I said the Attorney General to make it more responsive to the difference between legal and political problems, which I have come to believe, strangely enough, after all these years of trying to figure out what you can do, I have oftentimes tried to figure out whether or not the isolation of the court, the magistracy of the court, so to speak, how you could get public input so that they had some idea. And I thought about ideas of citizens' council and so forth. And I really don't know. I don't know anywhere that they have effectively done that. But it seems to me that we do get at times fairly far from what the public sort of takes a view, and rightly or wrongly, sort of either condemns the court for it or something like that without understanding what the process is. I have a story I tell. Years ago, when I was first appointed to the court, my next door neighbor had his children were roughly the same age as mine, and we were good friends. And their kids played together, and we'd share the backyard barbecue and all of that. And when I was appointed to the court, it sort of drifted. I couldn't have a beer with him and so forth. And finally, when an announcement was in the newspaper 6 or 7 years later that I was retiring, he ran over, threw his arms around me, and said, "Oh, thank God I can talk to you again." And that's a truism. He was afraid to talk to me because somehow he would affect the natural order of things, or God would strike him dead, or some other reason why this had happened. And of course, nothing's further from the truth. What you really need was honest criticism. Somebody would say, "My God, Erwin, you're nuts. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard of." Is really something you need, because what you hear, and this goes without question, "You're wonderful, you're doing a good job," you're this. People who don't want to say a bad thing. And you don't need that. Not at all. The drumbeat of praise is, I'm quite frank, when I had a law clerk that started that, I started to grill the hell out of him about what he was doing, because that's not true. You know, I left my piece of paper on the desk several times, hoping the Almighty would write a few lines or a few words for me to put me on the right track. And it never happened. Hopefully, from inside of me came that inspiration. But you can't. It's not a job for an ego. It's a job for somebody who's constantly examining the basis of what you're doing and trying to order or reorder all those priorities in society that take place. And so if you can't do that, or if you feel yourself constantly leaning one way, you have to understand why. Now, every human being has certain prejudices by virtue of education, background, religion, whatever it is. And so you're taught one thing, and you have to learn to balance those things against what other people are taught and think of. And the law is one way we can do that. But your ability to do so is limited by your ability, truly. And therefore, the future, you have no idea what's going to happen in the future. So you have to do your best and hope for the best. And as John Diamond told me, a really good judge is one who makes mistakes and lives long enough to correct them. That's it.
Well, you've been outside looking at the system, and I've always known you to have a sharp and critical eye. And what do you think the main challenges are to the system right now?
Well, the problem is we're now in what I would call either the third or fourth generation of judges, as we've changed over. And there are two things which I see which really surprise me. One thing is, here in Alaska, the judges retire at an incredibly early age. Now, I don't know why. You know, you can benefit from experience. And in my opinion, we're not getting that experience. When they get to be mid-50s, they're gone. Now, we really need those people. Mm-hmm. Now, before, you know, we had older people, Moody and people like Ed Davis. Yeah, Buckaloo. We had people with background experience on the bench. If you come on the bench, it takes you a while to pick up the experience and the way people are and the way lawyers are. Then, by the time you get to be experienced, you're gone. You're taking another job or whatever it is. That sort of trend kind of bothers me, because you don't have the experience when you go on, you go off when you get it, and therefore you're using it somewhere else. I don't know what's causing that. I don't know if it's economics, but it's really unusual to me. I mean, we have all kinds of applicants for the job, so we're not, but they leave early. And so that kind of bothers me in the sense that they, and the other thing is that we have the old ones, you know. We have no way to offer constructive criticism to those who don't learn very fast. And of course, there are always those that no matter how you appoint a judge, it always comes out the same way. 20% of them are very good, 20% of them are very poor, and the rest of them are in the middle. And so somehow the ones that are poor, they serve too. Mm-hmm. And the 20% of the people that appear before a poor judge tell all their friends what a poor judge he is, and they really are a huge detriment to the system. And how you can get that criticism back, I've struggled with all my life, only, and quite honestly, by the fact that I've served in all these positions. I was born in Alaska. They have to listen to my criticism. I mean, but they don't know how to say, no, you can't have an audience. And so, and of course, they've learned years that saying no to me is not a fairly difficult thing to do, and I express my opinion anyway. But there are consequences to criticism, of course, but we need some way to tell them, look, you're not doing well. And it's an honest thing. It's not because I dislike you personally or something like that. Joe out here, I mean, you hurt him badly and you made a wrong decision. And how can we go about that? And so it's interesting because I still talk to the judges from all around the state and still know a number of them. And they come in and they go to conferences and they say, gee, I just heard so-and-so say this or do this or he's doing that. He says, that's not right. And, well, can you talk to him? No, I can't talk to him. Well, you know, there's got to be some mechanism by which we do that. You were able to do some of that. But it's hard for an administrator to say to a judge, God damn it, you're not doing your job. You know, I mean, or, you know, and that's, you know, it's just like in the administrative setting, saying, judge, you know, I know you're going on vacation, but your secretary is not going on vacation. She's got to stay here at work. You know, that's one of the problems. And of course, we do forget the one thing. In the United States, there are not a lot of judges for 300 million people. You know, and I think at one time when I was appointed, there were 500 appellate judges in the United States. They're probably double that now. But when you think of about 1,000 appellate judges for 3 million people, you understand that there is an ego that which goes along with it. And say, how you penetrate that ego, I can't answer. I'm a bit lucky. Frankly, my ego started out intact, and I never decided that because I got appointed, I was really entitled to it. And so it's fascinating. I have colleagues who, I mean, it's the epitome of their success in life. Mm-hmm. And to that, I think, you know, it's a satisfaction. I'm different than that. And whether or not that's good or bad, I leave others to say. But I saw it as maybe I could be of some help. And then when I left for a while, I thought, well, now that I've been on the inside, maybe I could be on the outside and change something. And I did learn one thing. The strength of the system is no one person can have a profound effect on it.
Probably very true. Let me ask you one last question, because I really would like to hear what you have to say about this. Looking back on your life to date, I'd like you to tell me if there are any people or events in your life who have had a particularly profound influence on your view of the world.
I've got to think about that for a little bit for two reasons. One, I'm very, most people are not aware, I'm Roman Catholic, but I'm intensely religious. And so as my children were growing up, they attended a variety of church affairs, both nationally and internationally and so forth. And my one son, as a young man, went to Rome and spent a day with Mother Teresa. And he came back, and he's a very, very strong man, very much like I am, and very, very outgoing and so forth. And he was profoundly affected, and he explained to me what he felt about Mother Teresa, who apparently was only about 4 foot 10, and instead of most people, when they describe her, think she's 10 foot 4. And so, about the idea of service, and about her feeling for children and so forth. And most of my life, outside of being a lawyer and so forth, has been attempting to help children in all intents forms. I've been on the board for a whole number of nonprofits, and of course, then I spent a lot of time helping, like I helped found Beans Cafe, served on the board for a number of years, and helped with St. Francis Shelter, and for a number of times as chairman of the mayor's committee on the street people and how you deal with those kind of things. And that, and then handicapped children. One of my grandchildren was a fetal alcohol child, and we put a lot of time and effort into the fetal alcohol educational process and that sort of thing. And my daughter adopted the little boy, and it's been a rather profound experience. So that, the idea of service, and particularly helping those that don't have anything. My father was a great proponent of the idea that those that had the more had to give more, and that your responsibility was to help. You got more to help, do something with it. And that's something which both my mother and he, that's what we did. So that component of my life has been reflected in the religious evidence. Now, I had a rather unique experience here, you may be aware of. I was picked to by the Catholic Church to go through and determine whether or not there had been sexual abuse in the Archdiocese from its founding, which I, as a private counsel, I established the Archdiocese of Anchorage in the late 70s. I knew all the priests, almost every one of them, and so I was commissioned with the Superior Court Judge and the founder of, or the operator of the Catholic home over here. And it's a very, when you understand the workings of the church and you understand the people and you understand the vows that are taken, it's rather appalling to go through that step by step and examine each priest's life and the service and so forth. And I knew when I did it that when I got through, and the report, which was as absolutely straight as we could make it, that there would be those that would be terribly offended by the idea. And of course, when you don't like something that happens, what you do is you reach out and you point, that's him again. So I knew from then on, there'd be people I'd known for years who would not, wouldn't be happy with the result, and particularly would describe it to me, and that was fine. And I thought one of the things about serving in public life for a long period of time is I figured that I had seen this in action a great deal, and there are those that have never. And so therefore, I could take it if they couldn't, let's put it that way. So again, that was part, it didn't shake my faith in my religious faith, but it certainly put greater parameters on what follies human beings can engage in, yes. Put it that way. And it's difficult. We had a very good priest here, one of the true Christian priests I've ever met, who, when he came and when he left, did the same thing. He had a large piece of plastic, very ugly, garish plastic and so forth, and he would start out and he would swing it over his head. And it had perforations in it, and the faster you swing it, the more beautiful the music became. And when he was really twirling the thing, it had a really beautiful sound. And he said, now, he said, I want you to know, as he said, that is the word of God. I am the person swinging that. And he said, listen to the music, not to me. And I thought, that's very apt. And that fit that circumstance a great deal. But when I ask around, and you say, what, this is the Archdiocese of Anchorage, and this is the place, Interestingly enough, the report shows up in the bankruptcy proceedings across the United States in various dioceses. It's on the internet for the Bush. I have people in the Bush call me. And so you wonder, you know, what effect does that have on anyone's life? So that's one part of my life. And so, as I say, the religious end of it, and this young priest, who is now unfortunately totally disabled by Alzheimer's, very, very wonderful man, that played a rather profound effect on my life. And then legally, Jay Rabinowitz, he was my boss in Juneau. He was a brilliant, he was a Superior Court judge when I was DA in Fairbanks. I presented a number of cases to him. He was, on the Supreme Court. He was both Chief Justice and otherwise. And though we always didn't agree personally, I knew that he gave his absolute best. He was a brilliant judge. He had a capacity for work, which was phenomenal. And he literally tried to do what was the best thing. Now, with his talent and his ability, he would inspire you to do that yourself. And so that he, in later years, I regretted we did not, we weren't personally close, but he really set a standard by which you could perform. And he demanded those that work for to perform to that standard. And so when you have that kind of a thing, it's easy to perform at a higher level because it's expected. He wasn't satisfied with what was half or anything like that. And, you know, it's, I know we talked to law clerks about, you know, gosh, you got to do better than that. This isn't too good. It's, the problem always is the better you are, the greater for the clamor that you're perfect. And nobody is perfect.
Nobody.
That's the worst. That's the part of it. Let's put it that way. And so, you know, we did share a lot of similar things. His twins were born at the same time, 1970, that my youngest child was born. So, you know, here we have a court with little kids and little, so he had, we did share a family type thing, of the growing up, we had that responsibility on the court and so forth. And in that, we were entirely different, I think, than the other members of the court from that standpoint, who had either gone through that or hadn't put it together very well, let's put it that way.
Well, Bob, it's been an honor and a privilege to interview you and see you again.
That's good, Art. It's always, as I said to other members of the court, you know, I won't say any of the things that are good. I'm fairly certain of rewriting the history of the court system now that I'm probably the only person left who has a fluid memory of exactly what happened, and having to be standing there when it happened is kind of fascinating.
Oh, I think it is.
Yeah, you know, you get that. You get, there are people now that forget all of the, they remember bits of it, let's put it that way, you know. As I laugh, you don't, what happened and what appeared to happen are two different things.
Well, it was, you know, I found it exciting to come up here and watch this court grow and I hadn't realized really that to the extent that and how early you were involved, that statehood, that was a fascinating part of the interview. I was enraptured.
Well, you don't, you know, and the first administrative director of the court was David Lutz. And of course, he was the graduation speaker at Nome High School in 1960 when I was there. Now, David Lutz went back to Washington and became what, director, some a fairly high official in the administration, and he was a very brilliant guy, but Nesbitt wouldn't listen to him. And I mean, he discovered that and he left, so to say, good, because he wouldn't listen to him, you know. We're talking, and so then Nesbitt brought in Tom Stewart, who I love as a delightful man, but Tom is not strong enough to withstand.
No, he was out gardening.
Yeah, literally. And, you know, he's a Juno boy and as nice a man as you're ever going to find, practically.
True.
But he couldn't, and this, but he was totally unyielding. I mean, it was his way or no way. I mean, that his entire life was that way, you know. I tell, there are two stories I had. I learned from one side. I went to a national judicial conference, and there was a justice from Wisconsin, And he rushes up to me and he said, "Is Bill Nesbitt still Chief Justice?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "That's the man that Captain Queeg was patterned after." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "He was my commander of a destroyer at D-Day." And he said, "He was crazy. He ran the destroyer aground." And he said, that he said the man was, he said, "I almost got court-martialed. I tried to have him removed." So this is one story. Then another one, after he retired, I was talking to some guy, and he said to me, "Do you know Bill Nesbitt?" He said, "Yes." He said, "God, I'm out here fishing over at one some lake, Patrick Lakes or something like that." And I said, "God, I look down there, and there's some guy pulling a rowboat in the middle of the river. He's got on waders, and it's up to his waist, just struggling up the river." And he said, "I watch him for about an hour and a half." And he said, "He finally pulls his rowboat about 2 or 3 miles up the stream and so forth. And he pulls it up on the bank and he stops, and he, it was Bill Nesbitt." And of course, he's recovering from a plane crash. You know, he's physically, his way to show it is to go out there and walk up the river in cold water pulling a rowboat. You know, and he said that epitomized him right to the end. I mean, there's no way that was going to be any way but his way.
I never got to meet him when he was on the bench. I met him once afterwards.
Well, I represented him personally. I did that. And I will say this, the ultimate result is he, we had a very interesting case, and I guess all public records, of which many years ago from Haines to Anchorage, there's a bus line called the O'Hara Bus Line, and it went bankrupt, and Buell represented him personally. Well, there was property over against the old ENS hospital, and he owned some of it, and the government condemned some of it, but Buell filed an attorney's lien for all the thing in the bankruptcy. And for years, there were federal statutes, which he was about fourth or fifth. And then over the years, they would change a little bit, and the leads, his lien would come up in priority, his names would go down. And there were several times along the way where he was offered, a few dollars to 20% to this or that. No. It had absolutely no legal basis. And he held on, and, you know, after 20 years, he ended up on the top. And he got to foreclose his lien, and he got those two lots, which were at that time worth a couple $100,000. But I mean, representing him was a nightmare. You couldn't get him, you know. I mean, he was no, you know.
Well, I'm glad I came when the five of you were there, I'll tell you, because I doubt I would have fared very well with Buell.
Well, he wouldn't. It was his way, and he had the final decision, and then that's why it didn't work at all. I mean, we knew it wouldn't work, and of course, and George thought he could work it the same way, but George, as much as he wanted to be that way, didn't have the same kind of personality. So when he appointed a friend, he expected the friend to do the work, but the friend wasn't qualified to do the work, and so then ran amok. So that's what happened. It just, and he finally came to the conclusion that it wouldn't work, you know, which was kind of a surprise, because he just didn't. It finally came to him as your friend being here isn't going to be helpful at all, because you're not interested in making every decision in the whole thing, and they have to be made. That's really what it came down to. He wanted to do something else. And Nesbitt wanted to count the paper clips and whatever else where he was available, and he did. Counted every one of them.
Yeah, well, when the court system started, it didn't have much money, so.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, most people, and this, you might turn this off, I'm going to tell Art this, probably shouldn't be on the camera. What happened was, is nobody expected Bill Nesbitt to be appointed Chief Justice. Everybody expected that Bill Egan would appoint his boyhood companion, who was John Dunn. A lot of personalities were at work. But what nobody knew is Bill Egan and Bill Nesbitt campaigned for the state territorial legislature together, and for some reason Bill Egan took a liking to Nesbitt. And then the huge fight over was who's going to be the Chief Justice. And Bill, for reasons of his own, didn't think John Diamond was forceful enough for the job.
I think he would have been perfect.
Oh, I thought he would too. But I mean, Bill Egan was a very remarkable man,
yes,
in his own way. And I mean, he went his own way. So when the smoke cleared away and he appointed Nesbitt, they were stunned. Because he was the least qualified to get the candidate. So that was the strange part about that. He really was the least qualified. And of course he had this, he had been an alcoholic, you know, and then he's a recovering alcoholic. And I mean, some of his exploits were just unbelievable. Like true. I mean, if they weren't true, that would be something else. But
no, you know, I heard some great stories.
Oh, he had 10 or 12 plane crashes, you know, and he'd been to Shadles about three or four times. And I mean, you name it, it had happened.
Yeah,
you know, and so when you say, Bill, how the hell did you appoint him? You know, Bill never explained it. And then the only, what they fell out over was nobody suspected for years he was anti-Semitic. And so when Jade came for Jay's appointment, he went to Bill Egan and demanded he not appoint him. And Bill was appalled. And that's, but I mean, nobody suspected. I mean, I know what happened. I need to tell you that because, you know, of other aspects, so you understand. The people on the judicial council were personal friends of my parents. My mother had taught Ernie Bailey in high school, and he had come from a family, and she turned him around and so forth. And he and Bill Stump, who were full brothers, revered my mother. Okay, Jack Warner at Seward was, of course, a friend of my father's. Harry Cross at Kotzebue was a close personal friend of my father. So I knew what went on in all the council meetings. And then later on, Paul Gabor in Fairbanks was a personal friend, and we used to talk about the council and the appointments of people. So, you know, and I, of course, participated in the original appointment of Jay and ultimately his appointment to the Supreme Court. So what's happening is Jay's appointment was the only time the private members of the council all voted against the Chief Justice, the first time it ever happened. All three of them voted against the Chief Justice, and he was stunned.
Yeah.
You see, that's what, but those things, you know, you didn't, and nobody, don't ask me, nobody talked about those things in the beginning, you know. Just one of those things, not the thing that people will, you know, your oral history.
No, you don't.
Everybody's got a theory as to what happened, you know, you just, I was just there when it happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's sitting there, you know, it's like sitting in a room and watching the